Today is April the 4th, 2018. The revenue man reminds us the due date is April the 17th. Make sure you get your filing in. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5, on the radio, and PRN.FM, on the internet each Wednesday, with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are, well, slightly different. Before we get to the main headline news tonight, we'll first report of news with critical dates that affect the user community. The first item is Google URL Shortener is shutting down. Amazon Music Storage is shutting down, and Linux Kernel is dropping support of legacy peripherals. This will be followed by tech news during the past week. The release of Android Go, a stripped-down version of Oreo, Cloudflare, which is a privacy-first DNS service, how Google tracks you and what can you do about it, and MIT squeezing water out of the air. And of course, we do have a follow-up on the continuing saga of Facebook. In the feature section this evening, from the Tech Corner, I have prepared a segment on the Apple iPad versus the Google Chromebook. And Marty Winston in Home Automation has a segment on calling for help automatically from a cybernetic house. Google is shutting down its goo.gl URL shortening service. URL shorteners can be both useful and fun. Google takes on the tech launch in 2009 and added a third-party API, the ability to create QR code, and the power to link right to iOS and Android apps. Unfortunately, Google is replacing its own service, goo.gl, with Firebase Dynamic Links, that's FDL, as of April the 13th. These new smart URLs let you send folks to any location within iOS, Android, or web apps. You won't be able to create new goo.el shortlinks after the 13th, but existing users can manage them via the goo.gl console for the next year. After that, all the links will still work, but you won't be able to access the console itself after March the 30th, 2019. Google suggests creating FDLs from now on using other shortening services like Bitly, that's B-I-T-L-Y, and Owly, O-W.L-Y. Amazon warns that you have 30 days before they end music storage files. Amazon says subscribers to its music storage service have 30 days to claim any song files they have stored on their service or lose them forever. Amazon says that on April the 29th, new subscriptions to music storage will be cut off and current subscriptions will be allowed to run out. When that happens, those who have not requested that Amazon save the MP3 files will lose them for good. To keep your files on Amazon's server, you need to log into your account and check the Keep My Songs option in your settings. This will preserve your songs until January 2019, when the host storage service will be shut down. The move is part of Amazon to rid itself of music storage offering that allows customers to upload and store their MP3 files. The service will still operate for those who already have a subscription, though they won't be able to renew their subscription when it ends. Other parts of Amazon Music, including the Prime Music and Music Unlimited services, will continue to be active. I've been often asked, what can I do with an old PC system? I have suggested installing a Linux distro to replace the old copy of Windows that is no longer supported. They are easy to install as they support legacy hardware that may no longer be supported in the latest Windows operating system. They run without problems on old systems with slow CPU and limited memory storage. These distros include the latest copy of Firefox for access to the internet. There is OpenOffice for office functions. You can easily install WPS, which is a very close clone of Microsoft's Office, Excel, PowerPoint, and Word. The software itself is free. The new Linux kernel in an upcoming release have taken the decision to drop support for old CPU architecture. This enables them to drop 500,000 lines of coding, which is currently contained in 20.3 million lines of code. Killing off support for these architecture is beneficial for a few reasons. It'll reduce the size of the kernel, and it could also reduce the amount of attack vectors within the kernel if there were any bugs lurking. But it also signals that old computing systems can now just rest in peace at the recycle center near you. The first version of the Android Go is a smartphone built on Android 8.1 Oreo, and the operating system also has data management features integrated at a system-wide level, giving you the ability to closely monitor data usage. And like all devices certified by Google, Android Go phones will come with Android Play Protect out of the box. ZTE is the first company to bring a stripped-down smartphone running Android Go to the United States. The ZTE is now available to buy online for under $80. However, I recommend you spend the $20 more for the Moto G4, which is a full-fledged smartphone for $100. No sense playing around with a little toy. Cloudflare, CloudFlare, makes it harder for ISP to track your web history. If you're privacy-minded, you probably aren't thrilled that governments seem hell-bent on giving internet providers free rein over your browsing data. Cloudflare just gave you a tool to fight back. They launched a free domain name system service, the technology that translates IP addresses to web domains, that promises to prevent ISPs from easily tracking your web history. Just point your DNS setting to the address 1.1.1.1, and it will not only prevent your ISP from easily monitoring your site visits. Cloudflare even went so far as to have KPMG audit its code on a yearly basis to publicly confirm that it's doing what it promised. This, however, doesn't guarantee that your info is completely secure, since DNS by its nature isn't encrypted. Big Brother is watching you. And I just don't mean Facebook. Are you curious to see how much Google knows about your likes, history, and movements? Download your Google data. Google tracks even more of our lives as more people use Google for many other parts of their days, including email, calendar, web browsing, and the Android mobile operating system, which has an 85% market share of smartphones, according to a market tracker, IDC. With Google Maps and Waze, Google can keep tabs on your every move, but the very nature of Google apps and products, which also includes number one video site YouTube, means that it may be keeping more on you than you may realize. How can you get more information about what they know about you? Go to the website. Take care to write this down carefully. takeout.google.com/settings/takeout. Let me repeat that. Takeout, takeout.google.com/settings, settings/takeout. This is an old adage. You can't get blood out of a stone. MIT, however, has a variation on this. MIT has a new device that can pull water from desert air. A team at MIT is showing off a new device it's been field testing in Tempe, Arizona, that it says is capable of doing precisely that. The solar-powered system utilizes metal organic frameworks, MOF, that are able to pull water out of extremely dry desert air as low as 10% humidity. An impressive feat given that most similar technologies require more than 50%. The system, which the school is regarding as a proof of concept, was positioned on an Arizona State University roof. It's still early stages and water only measured in millimeters, but what was collected was devoid of impurities and served as a promising start. There's nothing from the MOF that leaches into the water. The material is very stable and it can yield high quality water. The device has no moving parts and it can be set and forgotten about for some time while it goes to work. The key to producing legitimately useful quantities of water, however, is going to be a matter of a fairly massive scale. I'll drink to that. In a 2016 employee memo that was leaked this week, a Facebook executive defended the company's questionable data mining practices and championed the growth of social media at any cost, apparently even death. Maybe it costs a life by exposing someone to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools. And still, we connect people. The ugly truth is that we believe in connecting people so deeply that anything allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good. That's why all the work we do in growth is justified. All the questionable contact importing practices, all the subtle language that helps people stay searchable by friends, all the work we do bring more communications in, the work we will likely have to do in China someday, all of it. In almost our work, we have to answer hard questions about what we believe. We have to justify the metrics and make sure they aren't losing out on a bigger picture. But connecting people, that's our imperative, because that's what we do, we connect people. This was a memo written by a vice president at Facebook, Andrew Bosworth, as reported by BuzzFeed, published last Thursday. BuzzFeed noted that the memo was written almost immediately after a man was shot to death while streaming live video of himself with Facebook Live, and a few days before a Palestinian teenager was accused of killing an Israeli girl after praising terrorists on Facebook. These deaths were a prelude to a string of other gruesome and violent incidents that appeared in videos and live streams on the social network. A man posted a Facebook video of himself killing someone last April. A month later, a man soaked himself in kerosene, lit himself on fire, and used Facebook Live to stream video of his self-immolation. While Bosworth now argues that he was playing devil's advocate in his memo, he wrote at the time that Facebook, by necessity, would keep connecting people and expanding no matter how ugly the cost. Bosworth, who oversaw Facebook's advertising and business platform at the time, has acknowledged writing the message, but said he intended only to start a debate. I didn't agree with it, even when I wrote it. Then why was it left posted on the company website for almost 2 years? It has now since been taken down. Facebook chief executive Mark Zuckerberg disavowed the memo. Zuckerberg said in a statement using Bosworth's nickname, "Boz is a talented leader who says many provocative things. This was one that most at Facebook, including myself, disagreed with strongly. We've never believed the end justifies the means." The memo frames around Zuckerberg's often stated mission to connect the entire world through Facebook as the company's ultimate and unchangeable goal, whether those connections let users fall in love, attack each other, or in the memo's most extreme example, coordinate a terrorist attack. The memo drew criticism after it leaked this week. Bosworth has continued to defend the memo as a thought exercise, arguing on Twitter with people who were skeptical that he hadn't meant every word he wrote. At least some Facebook critics accepted Bosworth's defense that he had merely been trying to provoke. Bosworth deleted the 2016 memo after learning it had been obtained by reporters last week, and then wrote a new memo to employees in which he complained about the initial leak. Bosworth wrote, "If we had to live in fear that even our bad ideas would be exposed, then we won't explore them or understand them as much. We run a much greater risk of stumbling on them later." Andrew Bosworth has since backtracked the 2016 post, which he argues that social media success is welcome, even if connecting people costs a life. Vice President Andrew Bosworth later admitted that connecting people can be bad if they make it negative. Maybe it costs a life by exposing someone to bullies. Maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our twos. The ugly truth is that we believe in connecting people so deeply that anything that allows us to connect more people more often is de facto good. The internal memo entitled The Ugly was obtained and published by BuzzFeed. Bosworth said that he only intended to encourage discussion and that post did not represent his views or those of Facebook. I don't agree with the post today, and I didn't agree with it even when I wrote it. This is an editorial comment. Then why did he write it? If you don't believe in it, then why did you publish it? I care deeply, he said, how our product affects people, and I take very personally the responsibility I have to make that impact positive. It was intended to be provocative. This was one of the most unpopular things I've ever written internally, helped shape our twos for the better, he said in a follow-up tweet. It was poorly written, and worse, it was posted for 2 years. What would you think was the objective of the memo? Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said, "We never believe the ends justify the means. We recognize that connecting people isn't enough by itself. We also need to work to bring people closer together. We change our whole mission and company focus to reflect this last year." Apple CEO Tim Cook criticized Facebook as a social media site continues to make headlines in light of data privacy concerns raised by the scandal. At a town hall event hosted by MSNBC, Cook had some heated words for the social media giant. Cook said, "Facebook's detailed personal information on its users should not exist in the first place. I think the best regulation is no regulation." This is not what he said earlier last week. "Best regulation is no regulation. It should be self-regulation. However, I think we're beyond that here, and I do think that it's time for a set of people to think deeply about what can be done here." Cook said, "Privacy to us is a human right. It's a civil liberty and something that is unique to America. This is like freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Privacy is right up there with that for us." When asked at the event what he would do if he were in Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's predicament, he responded, "What would I do? I wouldn't be in this situation." Zuckerberg has apologized for the breach of information in a statement posted on his personal Facebook page. This is what he wrote. "We will learn from this experience to secure our platform further and make our community safer for everyone going forward." Speaking about Apple's business practices, Cook said, "The truth is we could make a ton of money if we monetize our customer. If our customer was our product, we've elected not to do that." Mark Zuckerberg fired back at Tim Cook. The Facebook CEO defended his company's business model in an interview published recently, arguing that recent criticism from his counterpart at Apple was unfounded. Cook recently called for increased regulation of social media and questioned the practice of monetizing user data on free platforms by selling ads that allow advertisers to target specific groups. Zuckerberg, in response to Cook's criticism, said, "You know, I find that argument that if you're not paying, that somehow we can't care about you, to be extremely glib and not at all aligned with the truth. The reality here is that if you want to build a service that helps others, connect everyone in the world, then there are a lot of people who can't afford to pay. Having an advertising-supported model is the only rational model that can support building this service." Cook said, "The truth is, we can make a lot of money if we monetize our customers. If our customers was our product, we've elected not to do that." Apple executives have in recent weeks used privacy and transparency as a sales pitch, drawing a contrast with other companies, especially Facebook in Silicon Valley. Apple makes the vast majority of its money selling hardware, including iPhones, iPads, and Macs. Facebook, on the other hand, has built an entire business on selling ads that target users based on information they provide. Zuckerberg said, "Facebook is dedicated to serving people despite its reliance on advertising." If you want to build a service which is just not serving rich people, then you need to have something that people can afford. I think it's important that we don't all get Stockholm Syndrome and let the companies that work hard to charge you more convince you that they actually care more about you. That was a dig at Apple. He went on to say that Facebook announced a redesign of its privacy tools as it comes under criticism for the handling of user data. Facebook responded to the intensifying criticism over its mishandling of user data by announcing new features to its site that will give users more visibility and control over how the information is shared. The changes, rolling out in coming weeks, will also enable users to prevent social networks from sharing that information with advertisers and other third parties. Facebook Chief Privacy Officer Erin Egan and Deputy General Counsel Ashley Berenger wrote in a statement, "Last week showed how much more work we need to do to enforce our policies and help people understand how Facebook works and the choices they have over their data. We've heard loud and clear that privacy settings and other important tools are too hard to find and that we must do more to keep people informed. The changes make it easier for users to see what information they shared, delete certain personal information, and control ads that they see. It is not clear whether this will mollify angry users, some of whom have called for a delete Facebook boycott." Facebook released these changes after coming under intense public and regulatory pressure for unauthorized disclosure of private information. An associate professor at the University of North Carolina noted that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg had promised simpler privacy controls in 2010. "The past decade shows that user concerns over privacy appears to have little teeth on showing how the platform behaves, aside from recycling of contrite statements and promises to do better from its CEO, as reported in the New York Times. Facebook says it's time to make our privacy tools easy to find." It's time? Well, here's Zuckerberg in 2010. "We've heard that feedback. There's need to be a simpler way to control your information. In the coming weeks, we will add privacy controls that are much simpler to use." Earlier this week, the Federal Trade Commission confirmed it is investigating the company's handling of data. Lawmakers worldwide have expressed their dissatisfaction with Facebook's largely quiet response to date. Zuckerberg has agreed to testify before Congress, facing lawmakers who have promised a crackdown by regulating the social network. And he has come under fierce criticism from British lawmakers after he declined to testify in London, promising to send instead another executive. If you don't want to be affected by Facebook, I would probably just take my name out of Facebook and be out of it. Last week, Apple made a serious push back into the education sector. This isn't anything new, though according to CEO Tim Cook, it's just the company going back to its roots. The centerpiece here is a new iPad, a 9.7-inch tablet with Apple Pencil. There's also a redesigned iWork suite that lets students doodle and create digital books within iPages, the schoolwork app for tracking schoolwork. Apple is hoping that that will be enough to win over the schools. Apple had educators on stage during its press conference, but they had been handpicked to extol the values of the iOS ecosystem. As everyone knows, Apple products don't come cheap. The company's pitching its latest entry-level iPad at $299 for educators, $30 less than retail. The problem is that with Chromebook, devices going for as low as $150 are cheaper alternatives for school districts, and that $299 price tag is just for the iPad. If teachers want a pencil, that's an extra $89, plus up to another $100 for a keyboard. That puts the total price closer to $500 for the full setup. Apple needs more than apps to win over educators. It needs to make its products more affordable. The majority at the event seems to think that the iPad, even starting at $299, is simply too expensive, especially when there are less costly devices like Chromebooks around. That said, many of them agree that the iPad can certainly make a difference in the classroom thanks to its lockdown ecosystem, which keeps kids from wandering around the internet. There are other factors to consider beyond the purchase price as well. Some school districts are better equipped than others to adopt their infrastructure to support management and maintenance of these devices. Others will simply not have the resources to sustain the use of student iPads. It depends on the district, the needs of a given community, the source of funding, the goals of administrators, and many other factors.
Then there are Chromebooks as an alternative or as a companion to the iPad. Student and faculty often have their own devices that they prefer, and when they arrive on campus, they just expect it to work seamlessly with the infrastructure of the institution. When users have selected a device that meets their needs functionally and financially, it may cause administrators to think twice about supporting a specific tablet. The increased size and functionality of cellular phones also be a contributing factor in the dwindling desire to own the latest tablet. The lack of an included keyboard peripheral for the iPad seems like a really poor choice. Teachers want students to produce writing that shows they understand the topic. It's a little difficult, although not impossible, to do that without a keyboard. Apple usually makes products marketed for higher-income customers, so it is no surprise that their product costs a lot and doesn't have everything you need out of the box. But Google has them beat in terms of classroom accessibility. Students have access to Google Suite, and many teachers utilize Google Classroom to distribute materials for lessons and track student progress. The updated, marginally cheaper iPad with pencil support does make Apple's tablet well-suited in some ways to the demanding, fast-paced environment of a school for music, animation, video editing, and green screening. iPads remain a high-quality package, and when children are engaged in such tasks, they're useful little tools. So, why has the reputation of iPads in education taken a nosedive in recent years? The raw truth is that Apple hasn't been doing the essential nitty-gritty homework that the education sector needs. So for technology to work in mass in schools, management of devices and teacher-student workflow needs to be almost flawless. Unfortunately for education, iOS is clearly optimized for individuals. iPad privacy settings is a scourge of many a school technician. Apps want to know if they can use the camera, access the mic, photo, etc., and that's all fair enough. What's not fair enough is that these settings can't be forced into on or off through Apple's deployment options on a third-party MDM, otherwise known as Mobile Device Management Solution. On top of all that, school tech departments must choose a third-party MDM for wireless deployment because Apple doesn't have the resources to create such a product itself. MDM companies seem to spend half their time chasing updates and bugs that Apple produces along the way. There is the loss of some great software when iOS 11 got rid of the 32-bit app support. Apple updated iOS and your favorite storybook app does not work anymore. If deployment issues are bad news, there are more fundamental issues that Apple may struggle to overcome for some time. There's a question mark over whether schools can be convinced that a touchscreen interface will actually let children learn relevant skills for exams and push them on with traditional subjects effectively. Teachers themselves seem generally more comfortable with fixed keyboard devices, and the Chromebook juggernaut is showing a level of productiveness in classrooms not seen before. Its web-based device management console also appears to be generally well-received by school tech departments. What should really be raising alarm bells for Apple, though, is that Google doesn't even appear to be trying that hard. When the team behind Google's Chrome OS software and Chromebook set out to reinvent the laptop, it quickly zeroed in on security as an area where it could bring a fresh perspective. The team wanted to build something that will fill this generation's need, as well as address the rising crop of threats facing PCs. Security was thought of very differently back then because there weren't as many security attack vectors there are today. Google sent out a prototype unit, the CR48, to security experts for feedback. The responses were surprising. There were hardly a peep when it came to security flaws. 9 years later, and Chromebooks are a smash success. Nearly 3 out of every 5 machines used in the schools run the Chrome OS. Thanks to the early focus on preventing cyber attacks, Chromebooks are also a hit with the security community. Security experts commonly recommend Chromebooks, whether it's for the relative who somehow always ends up with spyware 2 balls or the researcher heading to a hacker's meetup. And it's not about complicated encryption or security tricks. Chromebooks have gained popularity through a combination of affordability and simple but effective security. Google's laptop brand first debuted in 2010 as a stripped-down computer with a web browser as the main operating system. Back then, Chromebooks were slow to gain acceptance, because of their closed ecosystem, which meant an inability to download programs from the internet. Alongside the bare-bones OS came a set of security features that, more than 5 years later, companies like Microsoft are still trying to catch up to. Fewer software choices mean limited options for hackers. Chromebooks have a lot of strong security defaults. Google's approach is really great because it makes it less likely for the user to mess up. In response, Microsoft introduced Windows 10S, a lockdown version of its operating system that can run apps only from its approved app store. But there's a major difference in price. Chromebooks are cheap compared to iPads, which at their cheapest are still $329. MacBooks, however, are open like traditional Windows PCs and are also much more expensive. That's not to say Chrome OS is impervious to malware. Cybercriminals have figured out loopholes through Chrome extensions, like when 37,000 devices were hit by the fake version of the AdBlock Plus. Malicious Android apps have also been able to sneak through the Play Store. But Chrome OS users mostly avoided massive cyber attack campaigns, like getting locked up with ransomware, or hijacked to become part of a botnet. Major security flaws for Chrome OS, like ones that would give an attacker complete control, are so rare that Google offers rewards, up to $200,000 to anyone who can hack the system. While you can keep your computer secure through safe practices, antivirus scans, and beefing up your settings, Google sought to create the most secure system right from the first boot, assembly not required. If you want pre-hardened security, then Chromebooks are it, not because they're Google, but because Chrome OS was developed for years and it explicitly had web security as a core design principle. The three design requirements for the Chromebook were simplicity, security, and speed. The three ended up playing off each other. The Chrome OS team wanted to keep it simple for users so the machines could run faster. By limiting the playing field, the OS was able to shut out common attacks from a decade ago while preventing future tactics as well. Even if you don't know what attacks are coming in the future, you're limiting the combinations. Over the years, attackers would have to wind through a twisty maze of passage to get something that worked. But you can get only so far with simplicity alone. Google focused on four key features for the Chromebook that has been available ever since the first iteration in 2010. Sandboxing, verified boots, power washing, and quick updates. That's the fundamental difference between how Chrome OS works and how any other computer at that time worked. And here's a breakdown of the four key features. Sandboxing. The Chromebook's browser was designed so that each tab would be considered its own process, meaning it didn't need to go outside and access any other files. Data outside the browser would go through a tool the Chrome OS team called MiniJail, which makes sure that the system is delivering only the requested data and nothing more. So even if a browser-based attack passed through, it would only be on that specific tab. The next, verified boot. That is, this is Google's variation of secure boot, a feature available on Windows and Apple devices. The Apple team wanted to make sure that when Chromebook started, they were running software that couldn't be changed. Every single line of code that runs at startup is checked to make sure it came from Google and wasn't modified by malware. They've been thoughtful about that boot process so that when you hit the power button, you're able to trust that startup a bit more than with other devices. If anything was offered, it heads to a recovery mode for Chromebooks, which is also stored on the secure processor and can't be modified. Power washes. This feature allows people to completely reset their Chromebook to factory settings with a push of a single button, making it simple to get back to a clean slate. It is helpful for when you think you've been affected by malware, or if you're traveling and want to make sure you're not carrying any sensitive data on your devices. Going back to factory settings can often be difficult on other devices with multiple steps to return to square one. For Chrome OS, it's available right through the settings. And finally, there's patching. Security patches aren't unique to Chromebooks, but Google's process and dedication to their rollout is. The company guarantees a Chromebook will receive updates for up to 7 years after its first release. More than 90% of Chromebook users are still using the latest versions of software, according to Google. For any security flaws that need an urgent patch, Google is able to roll out the fix within 48 hours. The updates also happen in the background, thanks to a new process Chrome OS introduced with its debut. Instead of asking users to install the updates, Chrome OS has two copies of what's running, a version A and a version B. Whenever a new update comes, it happens on version B. And once everything is ready, the Chrome OS loads up the updated version at the next reboot. Apple announced a new iPad earlier this week at an education-focused event. Though it's rare for the company to directly acknowledge its competition during presentation, it made no secret the new iPad was aimed at one rival in particular, Chromebooks. The iPad, as some call it, came in at the same price as the previous model, but includes a faster processor and support for the Apple Pencil. At the same time, Apple announced a suite of new software tools to make the iPad more useful for academia. However, there are some weaknesses. It's expensive. iPads are flexible devices, but they give schools and students few options to meet their budget and necessities. Chromebooks, on the other hand, range from extremely cheap laptops to stylus toting two-in-ones to premium laptops. More recently, Google is making proper Chrome OS tablets as well. Living in Apple's walled garden always limits your choices. That's okay for adult consumers who can afford to spend more money making purchasing decisions as individuals, but for school districts with tight budgets and poor students, that lack of flexibility is a real deterrent. This extends to software. Even when using iPads, schools will often use Google apps because they work across a variety of devices. If you're using G Suite, those apps will work for students whether they're using a Chromebook, an iPad, or Windows PC at home. Apple solutions work best when you commit all or nothing to its products, something that simply isn't practical for many school districts. And that's not even factoring that in order to provide all the experiences Apple is promising, you need to buy accessories separately, potentially adding hundreds to the iPad base price. The Apple Pencil is an extra $89 for schools, $99 for individuals, although Logitech makes a $50 alternative without pressure sensitivity. If you want to connect it to a projector, TV, or USB device, you'll have to purchase accessory dongles. And that doesn't even include the most important accessory of them all. There's no keyboard. The most obvious critique against the iPad is possibly the most important one. The iPad doesn't have a keyboard. Apple didn't even think it was necessary to create an official keyboard for schools, leaving that task to accessory makers. And that's not even getting into the questionable typing experience on tablets in the first place. The iPad is an excellent media consumption device, and its powerful processor can be an extremely valuable accessory in classroom lessons and experiments. But when it comes to day-to-day work, kids need a keyboard and mouse. Typing papers on a tablet screen is even less comfortable than on a phone. Doing research on multiple topics is a hassle without proper Windows management and a mouse to copy and paste text. The iPad can't replace a traditional laptop experience. It's also worth noting that for some younger students, especially those who can't afford a computer at home, the devices they use in classrooms will be one of their primary interactions with computers. A Chromebook's traditional design translates better to the real work they might have to do late in life. Meanwhile, Chromebooks are only becoming more flexible, where iPads have hardly fundamentally changed since the original. Google has significantly improved Chrome OS with new form factors and price options. Android app compatibility and stylus support, short of having Apple software, Chromebooks can do most of what an iPad can and more. If Apple wants to make a dent on the Chromebooks market, it will have to evolve its tablet or create something else entirely.
Calling for help. The history of involving electronics in that since even before SOS and the alternatives for calling for help automatically from a cybernetic house and how disappearing communication alternatives limit our choices when the system needs to remain viable over the next 40 years.
My segment this time is about calling for help. Even cybernetic houses may face emergencies that they can't handle on their own, and for ours, there are some thorny complications in our expectation of making everything still work 40 years into the future. Here's a little irony to go with that. We make voice calls to 911 by using a U.S. Robotics USB modem that supports voice calling features. And those modems have become so rare that the one I have may be the last one there is. So, what's a designer to do? I keep finding that comparing what's happening now to the past is a useful guidepost when trying to anticipate how the future will compare to now. So let's go back to February 1st, 1904, when an instruction from Marconi International Marine Communication Company became effective, ordering the first standardized signal for emergencies, Morse code, radio, largely maritime. Radio operators at the time were already using the Morse code letters C and Q when calling out just to see if anybody was there. It was a pun for seek you, C-Q, seek you, and also for the French term sécurité. At the time, the letter D indicated urgency. So the 1904 Marconi Edict seemed like a no-brainer. CQD would be the Morse distress call. And later, that morphed into the mnemonic Seek You Danger or Seek You Distress. 4 years later, on July 1st, 1908, it was officially replaced by SOS. And by the way, that's a bit of a fib. The official distress call is ... No separation. 9 Morse code characters, 3 dots, 3 dashes, 3 dots. But the letters SOS are sent as ... Pause, ... Pause, ... Let's crank up the calendar again. Do you still have a CB radio? The Citizens Band radio service, as it still exists, to whatever extent it does still exist, has operated license-free on channels near 27 megahertz since, ironically, 9/11, 1958, September 11th, 1958. The FCC still designates CB Channel 9 as reserved for emergencies. There was a time police departments and others would monitor CB Channel 9 24/7, and police cars were tuned to Channel 9 on radios, the CB radios, in the car. But few, if any, still do. CB radio is no longer a viable way to expect help when you call for help. Up the calendar again. The National 911 Emergency Call Service started getting implemented in the late 1960s. I said started getting implemented because it didn't appear everywhere all at once. It started in a few major markets, it started a few test markets, and over time spread across the map. It's everywhere now, it's all around, and it's evolving. Most of today's contemporary dispatch systems are on E911. That's enhanced to work better with non-landline phone systems, including VoIP, voice over IP, and some mobile services. Its next upgrade, NG911, for next generation 911, is in the works now and will do a better job with mobile services, including texting. I should admit, I'm being a bit of a troublemaker right now and pushing that envelope a bit, trying to get the internet services that place cable modems or fiber modems in homes or businesses to develop a data API, application programming interface, because those systems already know the address where that fiber modem or cable modem is installed, which can help reduce the amount of information that a person in peril or a certified automatic alarm system would need to add to affect a full screen of info at the 911 dispatch center. It's nothing we need to worry about today. I will also admit to having been a loyalist to landlines, and I designed my automation to respond to what perils it senses by assembling a cogent voice message and phoning it in. Let me give you an example of what such a call might say. And in this case, the example assumes the house has within it somewhere a fire. Call might sound something like this. Emergency. This is the intelligent automated emergency response system at 123 Main Street reporting the detection of a fire within the structure. At this moment, two adults and two pets are inside the house. A front door panel will show the floor plan indicating the real-time locations of all remaining warm bodies and all hot spots. All exterior doors are now unlocked. All fans are off. The gas line is turned off. The fire suppression sprinkler system has been activated. There is no information available about the well-being of any remaining occupants. Interior alarms are sounding. Please dispatch a response. This is an automated message and will repeat three times or until you hang up. I did check with our local emergency coordinator and 911 system director. They say this is appropriate content, and they are happy to have notice as early as possible and as complete as possible. The house is designed so it can put together similar messages when, for example, it detects an intruder on the grounds outside the house, or an intruder inside the house, or when one of the residents signals trouble. But what I wanted to get into today is not so much the content of the call for help, but the likelihood that we can design a call for help today that can still be effective 40 years from now. Will our, POTS is plain old telephone service. It's an acronym for plain old telephone service, landlines, copper lines, analog phones, your grandma's telephone. Will our POTS landline still connect 40 years from now? Phone companies are working hard to get rid of copper lines. And cell service. Even if we could hack a mobile phone to interface with as readily as the landline, it seems unlikely that it'll still work 40 years from now on the same frequencies that our mobile phones are using today. VoIP service, those phones that come from your cable modem, your fiber modem, and so on, VoIP service is probably our best option right now for continued availability into the future. And as for that idea about an IP interface, well, we're likely to be a long way into that 40 years before it gets implemented. So let me share some advice that doesn't require a cybernetic house. In addition to keeping your smoke and fire detectors up to date, and maybe considering a fire suppression sprinkler system, have locks on your doors. Have fire extinguishers around the house. There are other things you might do. We have a Jack Russell. He's nice enough to people inside the house, but no one outside will fail to trigger a bark, growl, and snarl session, and no batteries are required. We don't leave garage doors open when we can't see into the garage. We don't park cars outdoors without locking them. We always cancel newspapers and postpone mail or package deliveries when we're away. We let the local police know we'll be away, and they're pretty good about eyeballing the house more often during that time. We do have lights that make it look like people are switching them on and off. If there's a more present danger, my wife and I have a drill when a situation turns tense. I hold my ground without creating an assault while she calls the police. I'm buying time. She's buying a response. If that doesn't work, I do have a couple of well-tuned handguns, but I also have training on their operation and on their appropriate usage and certification. It has never yet come to that. If it does turn out to be just me and the bad guys, I don't love those odds. So calling for help to get the pros to respond is our first choice. And even better, I look forward to the day when the house is smart enough to do it for me. Our cybernetic house, of course, will also do detailed logging and won't let video recorded during incidents or any other data get erased. So in a way, it will be a house with its own body cam. Well, 32 of them, 32 cameras monitoring the premises. And as Hank always advises, when it's peril time, the system does a real-time backup of that video. What are you backing up?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on shop technology Thursday, April the 5th at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on home automation Friday, April the 6th, 8 p.m. The meeting will be held at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Amazon Echo Dot Home Assistant, Thursday, April the 12th, at 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building, room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, April the 13th at 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and it will be at the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. The Princeton PCs User Group will be meeting Tuesday, April the 24th at 7 p.m., Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on VPN, the importance of having one, Thursday, April the 26th. The meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have their meeting on Tuesday, May 1st. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or www.wbai.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.